You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon. I'm Anthony Painter. I'm Director of Institutional Reform here at the RSA. I'm delighted to welcome you all to today's lunchtime talk. John Hills is Professor of Social Policy and Director of the Centre for Analysis of Social Exclusion at the London School of Economics. He's written extensively on inequality, public policy, the welfare state, and he was knighted in 2013 for services to the development of social policy. His latest book is Good Times, Bad Times, The Welfare Myth of Them and Us. Tom Clark is leader writer for The Guardian. He previously advised the last Labour government after 5 years at the Institute for Fiscal Studies, where he published widely on poverty, inequality and social security. His new book is Hard Times, Inequality, Recession, Aftermath. Both books are absolutely brilliant. And you can see this from the quantum of pages I folded over in Tom's book. And if you could see the highlights I've made in John's book on my iPad, you'd see a similar sort of pattern. They both show how data mixed with real-life stories can make a powerful emotive and political case. Today, John and Tom will explore the recession, the welfare state that we have built, and the ongoing impact on the fabric of our society. Our work here at the RSA is about exploring how people can reach their potential, how they can live creative lives. And because of this, we're interested in the recently controversial idea of a basic or citizen's income. And we're doing some modelling on that, so watch this space for that work. John and Tom may take a different route to helping those who live the most complex lives. But we may all find some agreement today on the fact that there is something seriously wrong with the current system. Something must be done. I hope that you all may well be convinced of that fact too. So, without further ado, let me join me in welcoming, first of all, Professor John Hills.
Well, thank you very much for inviting us here today, and thank you very much for giving up your lunch times, those of you who are in the audience. That's very good of you all. I really can say only a very little about what's in the book, but in fact the main thing you need to know is summarised in the title. We all of us over our lives go through good times and bad times, and our lives change. And what the book does is to report the results of a lot of research over the last decade or more within our own research centre and elsewhere about how people's lives change, both from the very short term through to over their whole lives, and then onto the next generation. And one of the implications of that, and it is only one of the implications of that, is that the idea that we're making policy and thinking about politics in a world where there's an unchanging group of them who are getting all the benefits, who never contribute, but get all the goodies, and a bigger group, equally unchanging, of us, who get nothing out of the system and who pay all the money, is a huge misrepresentation of what's going on. But it is a very pervasive idea that we are effectively, not in Disraeli's sense, but in another sense, in a kind of fiscal welfare sense, two nations of them and us. So this is the Chancellor talking in June 2013, I think just as I started writing the book. Two groups need to be satisfied with our welfare system. Those who need it, who've lost their job and who we as a compassionate society want to support. And there's a second group, the people who pay for this system, who go out to work, who pay their taxes and expect it to be fair on them too. In other words, two separate groups. And this is what we see the whole time in the strivers versus shirkers descriptions. Description of, which you hear on the left as well as on the right, of three generations in a family that have never worked. Chris Grayling, I was told, talked about four-generation families who've never worked, and somebody even spotted a reference to six-generation families that have never worked, which some of them may have their pictures on the wall, I guess, if you're affluent enough. And then Nick Clegg, I think, talked about people with their curtains drawn in mid-morning against alarm clock Britain. And in Australia, these people are known as leaners and lifters. So this is not just us. Now, this is a little test. I'm not expecting any of you to actually put your hands up. Andrew Dilnot probably would. But this is a question of just this is just one example of our ideas about turnover. So of every 100 people who sign on to Job Seekers Allowance, how many are still on Job Seekers Allowance after a year? Just have a quick thought. Well, when that question was asked back 18 months ago, or 2012, 2 years ago, the median answer was 50%. So half the population think that people spend at least half, at least a year on Job Seekers Allowance if they go on to it. The mean was pretty similar, 48%. And a quarter of people think that once you've signed on, two-thirds of people will stay on Job Seekers Allowance. These are some DWP numbers on how long people actually stay getting Job Seekers Allowance. Now, it has to be said that after a while, Job Seekers Allowance, it's quite hard to stay on Job Seekers Allowance because you're going to be moved on to other things and rotate through various programmes. But this is what it looked like before the crisis in April 2007. But you'll see that after a year before the crisis, about 7% of people were still on Job Seekers Allowance. Now, of course, that's changed with the crisis. This is people who started their claim in April 2009, and this is people who started their claim in April 2011. Even post-crisis, of the 100 people going on to Job Seekers Allowance, half stay on it for no more than 2 months, and only 10% stay on for as long as a year. There's a huge amount of turnover. And in the book, I go through other evidence about different kinds of short-term volatility in people's incomes, using evidence from before the days of zero-hours contracts. But there is a lot of movement from day to day and day to year. Let me take another side of this, which is our impressions of where the money is spent, because I think this is completely central to a lot of the debate at the moment about how we close the deficit, about how we reform public spending and so on. And in the last chapter of the book, I talk through some of these numbers. So, again, this is a question, the same survey from end of 2012, December 2012. First of all, the description, because this word welfare is very contested, but people are given the question, the government's welfare budget, it means Social Security and tax credits in this case, pays for pensions, tax credits, benefits for the unemployed, the disabled and other groups. Out of every £100, how much do you think is spent on benefits for unemployed people? So just think, okay. The median answer was 40%. Half of people think that we spend more than 40% of the whole Social Security and tax credit budget. The mean answer is 41%, and indeed 25% of people think we spend more than 60%. Now, in some ways, this isn't so surprising. Now, this is going to be, you keep these things on posterity. My annual tax summary, and therefore my income tax and national insurance, is now being beamed around the country, but there we go. If you can do the maths, you can work out what LSE pays me. Tens of millions of us, anyway, certainly millions of us have been sent this statement, which I know HMRC is having a bit of a hard time at the moment. I cannot believe that HMRC allowed themselves to be used for a piece of propaganda of this kind. This is a perfectly sensible device. It is a statement to me of the kind that my local council has been sending me for years and years and years of where my money goes. And it's actually quite helpful. I mean, you'll see that I spent, down at the bottom, of my taxes, £198 went as my contribution to the EU budget. That's probably a bargain, actually, given the advantages I get from the EU. And overseas aid, unfortunately, was only £303. But, these are small items. And you see they build up, and they're specially arranged so that the biggest item is at the top of the list. State pensions are there, and that means only the basic state pension, then education, then health, and then this enormous orange blob. A quarter of my money is going on welfare. Now, what isn't made clear in the notes that HMRC sent me was that includes judges' pensions, it includes all personal care for the elderly, it includes child benefit going to everybody, it includes benefits going to sick and disabled people, it includes tax credits for people who are working. It is not going on our image of welfare, in the sense of handouts, as people who, well, actually, DWP no longer works across the road, but people who work for DWP know this. That's not where their money goes. This is an alternative way of showing it, same thing. I mean, I work on the welfare state. Actually, two-thirds, not just that left-hand corner, goes on the welfare state. That's including the NHS, education, personal social services and social security, as well as tax credits. So if you mean the welfare state in the sort of Beveridge post-war sense, then actually they're understating it. It's two-thirds. On the other hand, if you mean out-of-work benefits for people who cash payments for people who aren't of pension age, actually the orange triangle should only be 5% of the pie chart. And if you mean unemployment benefits and associated with that housing benefit for people getting job seekers allowance, it's actually only 1% of public spending. So if you look at the numbers, the quote welfare debate is around payments to people who are out of work of working age. That's only £1 out of every £12.50 we spend on the welfare state. And actually, of that pound, only 20 pence is going on unemployment benefits and associated housing benefit. But that's where the debate is. We run from the idea that we're spending this very large amount of money on public spending, two-thirds of that on the welfare state, to the idea that it must be going to these handouts to this other group of people. And then, just associated with this, where's it going? So people think that 40% of the Social Security and tax credit budget goes on unemployment benefits. Within that, but asked about the whole thing, how much do people think is fraudulently claimed? Now we're kind of used, okay, there are signs on bus stops telling people that they're homing in on them. They know where their bank account in Switzerland is. How much is fraudulently claimed of that budget? Okay. Well, the median answer was 20%. The mean answer was 27%. That means, effectively, the mean answer is that of that spending, £56 billion is being fraudulently claimed. And in fact, a quarter of people think that it's 40% of the budget. Now, for that to be true, you know, given that spending on pensioner benefits, the state pension and other pensioner benefits, which are also in my orange triangle in my tax statement, by the way, is just over half the title. That means that everything claimed by non-pensioners is fraudulent. Those children don't really exist that you're getting child benefit for. Or some of the pensioners are cheating as well. They're lying about their age or something. Very cunning. DWP's estimate, when it does, and maybe somebody from DWP in the audience know exactly how they do it, but when they do random checks and do a detailed audit of people's cases, their estimate is that it's 0.7% of the budget, which actually, compared with insurance companies or banks, that's probably a rather low number. Job seekers allowance, more fraud than retirement pension, but still 2.9%, more comparable, I think, with credit cards and things like that, £150 million. Now, what that means is that if people have got in their heads in this debate that about a tenth of the Social Security budget consists of fraudulent claims by unemployed people, if you put together the two numbers I showed you. It's actually a thousandth. But our debate is completely dominated by that. Now, these myths affect things, and they affect people's lives, and they affect the debate we're having at the moment. For instance, if welfare is such a large part of the budget, obviously it can absorb a very large amount of the cuts, whether you think the cuts are necessary or not. But in fact, only 38 billion is going on, only, right? That's a large number, but everything else is even bigger, is going on benefits to people who are out of work, including lone parents, including sick and disabled people who are out of work and age. Now, what that means is, the implication of that, if we think we can get big savings out of what is actually only a very small part of the budget, you have to take more and more drastic action. And when you think, where have things like the bedroom tax, the minimum contributions to council tax payments come from, the explosion in sanctioning, where they've come from, they're the only way of making sizable savings out of a budget that is actually only a very small part of the total. Now, we're now talking on top, I think, on top of what's already been announced in terms of a freeze in most working age benefits from April next year for at least 2 years. We're now talking about a further, well, the government's been talking about a further £12.5 billion of savings from the welfare budget. Now, if they mean payments to out-of-work people, which is the way it's discussed, who are of working age, that's a third. In fact, if you extrapolate the numbers, Gavin Kelly from Resolution looked at the implications of what's been said about the path of deficit reduction, implied that we'll be taking £20 billion out of the budget by 2019-20. That's half. Now, just think about that for a minute. I think I would have, if I'd been giving this talk 3 years ago, I'd have said it is unimaginable that we would be contemplating halving that £38 billion, which is what is the implication of what we're doing, unless actually we're going to take the money from somewhere else. So that's one group of losers, people who are at the sharp end of this, where the evidence of rising hardship is growing. But the book argues and concludes by arguing that there's actually a much bigger group of losers, and that's actually all of us. Looking at the evidence about what happens over our lives, what happens over our children's lives, remembering that nearly all of the money is spent on health, schools and education, which pretty well everybody benefits from in some way or other, and certainly their families do at some point in their lives. And given that people's lives do change over time, and the hard-working families at one moment are quite often, not always, but are quite often the people whose curtains aren't necessarily drawn in mid-morning, but certainly who are looking for work and are claiming some of these benefits. If we persist in thinking that what we spend on the welfare state is nothing to do with us, then we're not serving our own interests. If we carry on thinking that there are easy savings to be made without touching the big-ticket items like pensions and health and schools, and crucially, without putting up taxes, then we're designing policy or encouraging people to design policy for a world that isn't going to serve the interests of the vast majority of the population. Thank you very much.
So, I mean, isn't it a great week for John to be making many of those points? You know, it's the week that started with policy-free spin, which was along the lines that said to benefit claimants, "Oi, you fat, get off the sofa." There's no policy, there's no real idea about how to make this idea of tackling obesity a reality. It's pure pre-election spin, pure divide and rule myth, them and us sort of stuff. But of course, as John's been saying, the valuable idea that he's putting forward is that if you, and he goes through this much more in the book than he was able to do in the brief talk there, is if you do a careful calculus of where welfare spending goes and you look at as people change over the life cycle, then what you see in reality of the figures rather than in the myth is that the welfare state is something which is not just there for an underclass minority, as it were, but for the middling majority, which is going to need it at some point or other. There'll be a pinch point where you need it. And that pinch point might come, you know, after a divorce, it might come on falling sick, or when you've got to take time out of work to look after an ailing relative. Or indeed, which is a particular point where my book comes in, it might happen if the good times suddenly stop to roll for everyone, as happened in spectacular fashion, of course, after the crisis in 2008. Now, the whole community then, in 2008, had reason to be grateful for the safety net, including very many people who never fell back on it directly. And that's because of the protection that Social Security provided for the purchasing power across the economy as a whole. When private incomes dry up, then Social Security comes in and makes good some of the damage, which is in the jargon what gets called provides the automatic stabilisers for the demand in the economy, stabilising against what would otherwise be even wilder vicissitudes of the business cycle. So whether we were claiming benefits or not, we had reason to be grateful for it at that point. But again, and this is the more distinctive book in the book Hard Times, it's not just the economy that would have been left very exposed without proper protection. It's also wider society too. And I tried to see how Britain had fared in the face of the slump using two of David Cameron's own concepts and phrases that he used very much in his younger days. The first was general well-being. I don't know if you remember, the young David Cameron used to talk about that we needed to worry about GWB and not GDP anymore. He was a kind of post-materialist guy who wasn't too fussed about money. He also used to say, of course, that we should worry a good deal about the big society, a phrase that lived on for slightly longer. So let's take both these ideas in turn and see how Britain fared in the face of recession, and then reflect on how the social security system's likely to interact with Britain's response. On general well-being first, I found a crystal clear link between economic insecurity on the one hand and psychological anxiety on the other. Now, this was evident very much when we spoke to individuals who told us how they were feeling, who'd been going through hard times. But here it is in a bit of data. This is from a very large YouGov piece of polling. Along the bottom there, we've chopped people up into how vulnerable they felt to the recession, or how affected by the recession they felt. So what we've got, what we might call the slump-proof people at this end of the scale, and the people who said their lives have been affected a great deal at the other end of the scale, I think there were roughly equal numbers of people in each of those categories. I mean, it's hard with charts because they're so often abused and the scales are squeezed around and so on. But look, this really does go from 0 up to 100 on the percent of each of these groups who are reporting feeling materially more anxious than they did a few years ago. And we can see that down at the bottom end of things, about one in the slump proof, if you like, about a fifth of people are saying, for whatever reason, they felt more anxious than they did a few years ago. But the people who felt really exposed to the recession, it was 80%. So that's a fourfold difference. And, you know, if you think of all the things that can unleash worry in the human heart, from turbulent teenagers to troubled romance, that's an extraordinary difference that we looks like it can be reduced to economic insecurity translating into psychological anxiety. It doesn't look like economic exposure is going to be very good for general well-being then. Now, when people feel anxious, they can also end up being atomised too, and that's because anxious people become less inclined to reach out to their fellow citizens and sometimes instead hunker down in their own homes and with their own worries. Now, we get a taste of what happened here in the immediate fallout of the recession. If we look at data on volunteering, this is from a very, very good official data set, the Citizenship Survey, which unfortunately itself has since fallen prey to hard times, being cut back early in the austerity programme. Here it is. Let's look at the dark green line for now. Forget about the light green one, which is how many hours on average right across the whole population are people putting into volunteering big society stuff through formally organised groups. You can see, again, this is a scale. There's no funny business going on. It goes right down to naught. You can see that, roughly speaking, people were volunteering on average a bit more than 3 hours just before the recession. And then at the trough of the recession, it drops down to, more like 2 hours. And once we smoothed out the data and did a few other things, it was still a fall off of over half an hour that seemed to be associated with the onset of recession, which is quite big when you consider there's plenty of people out there who are never going to be volunteering at all, and plenty of others who keep ploughing on regardless. You know, it's really quite a big change to have on average across the whole population. So that's formally organised do-gooding through big society-style clubs and organisations. But what I found even more chilling was what happened to more informal networks of kindness. Fortunately, we've got really good data on all kinds of good deeds that people might do for their neighbours, ranging from feeding the cat to minding a toddler or changing a light bulb for an old lady next door. Unfortunately, what it reveals, and this is the light green line this time, is that this sort of informal type of kindness is very economically exposed as well. Sometime there around 2008, going into 2009, you can see you get this really sharp dip, which in lots of ways in the book we go into and test whether that is to do with the economy, and we confirm that it is. And if you still need persuading that there is a connection here between people's economic exposure and their withdrawal, just look at the difference between different types of communities. Here, using one of the Whitehall definitions of poor wards of the country, and more prosperous wards, looking across a whole range of indicators of what makes a market town prosperous or a rundown inner city district rundown, we're able to break that drop in volunteering that we showed on the previous slide down across different regions. And we can see that it's so small, just a drop of a percentage point or so, in the rich areas, so small that it might be a quirk of the data. But in the poorer areas, it's really several times as big, and there's no doubt at all, I think, that it's real. So the places that could less afford to take it on the chin, least afford to take it on the chin, I think, were the ones who were most caught up in the kindness crunch, if you like. But of course, we're now in recovery, and you can quibble about the types of jobs there are. You can quibble about how long it's taken for wages to start picking up. But you know, the macro economy is now recovering. GDP is now bigger than it was before the crisis, and so you might hope some of these trends would start to improve again. But there isn't, and I just looked at this, updating the book, in the last month or two. The latest data doesn't show much sign of a pickup at all on these kind of measures. And it's not hard to see why. It's because if we're thinking about the poorest communities, which are ones that are taking the brunt, then whatever's happening to the macroeconomy, whatever's happening even to jobs, poverty rates are going to go up because there's no end to austerity for as far as the eye can see. These figures are from the start and end point there. I've just joined the dots, are from the Institute for Fiscal Studies projection. So you can see rises in the so-called returning good times in poverty rates for everyone, and particular rises for children looking ahead right through until we've had years and years of recovery. It's frustrating to see this happening when the economy's picking back up. These should be better times, but it looks for large parts of the country and the communities if they're not going to be better times at all. There's still important macroeconomic arguments to be had about, you know, would it be better to be funding more investment programmes and so on. I'm not qualified to make a judgment on that. But what I can say is that even if we could simply achieve a more balanced austerity with taxes doing some of the work rather than none of the work, as David Cameron plans, or with retrenchment on social security being shared more across the age range rather than pensioners being entirely protected and everything falling onto younger families, that would make a big difference to these sorts of figures, and I suggest to the knock-on effects on anxiety and social interaction of the sort that I'm talking about. So how do we make the case or the argument? It's difficult. There's no doubt. John has emphasised how many of these welfare myths have gained real traction. People believe them. And chapter 9 of my own book goes through the difficult, thorny political economy of making an argument in terms of social insurance, the old Beveridge argument, in a society that's got so unequal. You know, there's a lot of people who, because they own houses and they've got private pensions and so on, don't think they're going to need the welfare state. Persuading them otherwise is difficult. They might feel, when it comes to social insurance, that they've got nothing to insure against. But there is, and this is, I think, the big thing to campaign on and to cling on to, is that benefit cuts, and the ones that are in prospect now, are really beginning to hurt working Britain too. Now, this is true both directly, because so much of working Britain now needs tax credits and housing benefit to top them up, to allow them to subsist on the sort of miserable wages they're able to earn. And thus it was. I was pleased to see at the Conservative conference when George Osborne did his tough guy turn and said, he wanted to freeze benefits for years to come. It wasn't just The Guardian and people like me. It was the tabloids who turned on him for attacking working families too. But it's also true because of the indirect effect on terms and conditions that's starting to become evident when you think about terms and conditions. Like I wrote in the new edition of my book about this guy, John MacArthur, who's an intelligent 59-year-old man with a rich CV in a depressed area of Scotland. He was ordered recently by the Job Centre to go back to his old job and do it like he did before, but with the twist, he'd been laid off previously, and now he was told he had to go back and do it as a volunteer, working unpaid. Same job. Now, when you hear stories like that, you begin to understand why it is that the latest econometric analysis, people like Richard Blundell at UCL and Paul Gregg at Bath, are starting to acknowledge seriously the effect that welfare reforms are now exerting on terms and conditions across the workforce as a whole. Because if John MacArthur's being told he has to go and do the same job he used to have to do without a wage, and other people are feeling they can't get by even for a short period on reduced benefits, then there's going to be what MacArthur himself calls a conscript army at the door of many employers. And that is at some point soon enough going to start to affect working people as well as the workless, transcending the artificial divide imposed between the welfare them and the rest of us who are in work. Thank you very much.
Okay, John and Tom and I are just going to have a brief conversation. I'm going to open it out to you because I'm sure you've got lots of questions. There's a rich scene of analysis there. And I just want to start off with this question. If we were in a court of law right now and you presented your evidence to a magistrate, it would kind of be an open and shut case. The welfare state is a disaster and political approaches to the welfare state is a disaster. But if it was a court in front of a jury, you might find pressing your argument home more difficult. And just to take an example, the obesity announcement at the weekend about trying to force obese people into work or into a programme of recovery or sanctioning them, actually that policy is supported overwhelmingly by the public, a YouGov poll shows. So I wonder from your perspective, one, you must feel very frustrated at the evidence pointing one way and public opinion pointing another, and two, what you think it might take to convince that jury that this welfare state is deeply problematic. Let's go for John.
Well, can I take issue with that, I think? Because I think a lot of what I'm arguing in the book is that nearly all of us have a very big interest in the welfare state as it is. So it may be that ways that it is understood are misunderstood are a disaster, and they lead to a debate which is a long way divorced from certainly what the numbers and what the research and what the government's own figures suggest are the reality. But that actually those mechanisms, having a universal healthcare system, having state-funded schools, having at least a basic pension system, which most people will get the base of their retirement income from, plus a safety net, is something which a lot of us and our families have a very big interest in, but we often don't think we do. And I think that there's some cognitive dissonance here that you saw the numbers for what people think about the existence of this static group. I'm not saying there are no members of this static group there. It's just that they're completely unrepresentative for most of the people who benefit. But we have this picture that is remorselessly put in front of us, and indeed officially put in front of us by HMRC, amongst others, that points in a different direction from our own experience. But you know, we watch TV soaps. Some people listen to The Archers. We read a lot of novels. And we know about our lives. We know about our children's lives. And anybody who has a grandchild or a child in their 20s at the moment ought to know quite how tough the labour market is out there and has been for the last 6 years for people in their 20s. And we know our lives change. we know that happens. So we know, nothing in my book from the research evidence should come as a surprise, the extent to which we need these systems, but we switch off when we start talking about these concepts like welfare.
Yeah, interesting. And Tom, I just wonder whether inequality is a factor here. Have we sort of lost that sort of that touch with a wider community in some respects? Is inequality driving a social wedge in between different groups in a way that makes us, you know, one, that there is the point about the broad understanding of our own lives and how we interact with the tax benefit and public services, but also how other people might have to interact and how it might be difficult for them in a different way?
I think there's no doubt that inequality is very important. It could go either way, though. You know, you've got a divide that built up since the 70s between very hard-up people and the kind of comfortable two-thirds of people or so, you know, many of whom, by the way, have become a bit less comfortable in the last few years. But there's that divide, which obviously the one that the kind of the sort of benefit street stuff plays into. But you've also got the divide between, if you like, the 99% and the 1% and the runaway incomes at the top, which you might think would create a common grievance amongst the large majority. So I think if you just look at income distribution statistics, it kind of could go either way. And then the political question obviously is which divide becomes the important one, and the election maybe is a bit of a test of that. I think what you say is absolutely right. You might persuade a judge who is prepared to read documentation very carefully that that there was a real need for Social Security and that Social Security was being unfairly attacked. It might be harder to persuade someone who's looking at it in a more cursory way. And, you know, when we talk to lots and lots of people on benefits and people on low incomes, who we quote at length in the book, I'd expected to find the kind of resentment that George Osborne tries to inflame between alarm clock Britain, whatever you want to call it, and the people who are unemployed. And indeed we did. We found people saying, I wake up early, I do a job, it's bloody difficult, and other people don't have to do that, and that's not fair. But what I hadn't expected was just how fractured and atomised it is down there, that people on who are on unemployment benefit now say it's not fair because tax credits mean people who are in low pay but working are getting more of a top-up sometimes than they are. People who are on incapacity benefit mistrust people on unemployment benefit. People on unemployment benefit mistrust people on incapacity benefit. There's multiple quotes on all of these, this kind of division, that really illustrate these problems in the book. So that the lack of the solidarity that has to be the animating ethos for a successful welfare state. And why is it happening now? Well, I think, you know, there's some things to be grateful for when you think about the scale of the recession we've had, which is that we haven't had a return to the sort of racism that's often flared up in times of mass unemployment in the past, you know, from the National Front in the early 80s back to, if you want to go that far back, Germany in the 1930s. Instead, it seems, we've got an angry mood where a lot of people are pointing fingers at poor people, including poor people pointing the finger at other poor people. And so I'm left with this feeling that actually there's a lot of rage out there. I think that when you think we've had the biggest drop in wages since the 1860s, which I think I would have thought a few years ago was a hyperbolic thing to say, but I think is borne out by the data now. It's not surprised people are in a bad mood. They're not turning on ethnic minorities as they used to, but they feel the need to turn on someone, and I can understand why. So the question is, I think the realistic question is there something more useful that you can do to channel this anger? And all the discussions and arguments we've had on welfare, I've seen it happen once, which was early on in the Parliament. The government had a so-called work experience scheme, which involved people who were on stacking shelves at Tesco in return for their benefits, so doing unpaid work for Tesco. And the public turned very angrily against this because it's suddenly thought of Tesco as the sponge soaking up free labour, getting something for nothing. Within weeks, Tesco itself had pulled out as had other companies are involved, and the government eventually had to back down and say that was going to be a voluntary scheme and not a compulsory one. And so what I take away from that is that the country's in a mood to be angry with someone, it's in a mood to be angry with scroungers, but if it can make it corporate scroungers and Swiss tax dodgers instead of people on benefits, then we're in a very different position.
Yeah, it's interesting. And you know, the interesting thing about the evaluation of that scheme is the scheme's a failure. You know, it doesn't actually contribute to employment over a period of time, when employment of those who are previously on benefits. And yet it's resurfaced again, a version of it in the last few days, in terms of young people and getting them into work. So it's kind of, you know, the politics of it keeps on coming back. And I guess my question, therefore, is this a political challenge, or is there something in the design of the way particularly the social security system works that we need to look at in order to address some of these sort of fragmented attitudes, John?
Well, one of the themes running through my book, and there's a chapter headed, not that I ever saw the film, but there's a chapter headed "It's Complicated," is that people's lives are very complicated, and that does make life very difficult for running systems that are trying to cope with the difficulties of people's lives. Let me give you one example, which is what happened under the last government. Was that it introduced the tax credit system in one stage in 2001, then another stage in 2003. And when it reformed it in 2003, its idea was that in work support, making sure that otherwise relatively low-paid work paid, and people were a little bit further clear of the poverty line, but also there was a clear gain from working. But to destigmatize that, to make sure that people got it, that was made part of the income tax system, part of tax credits. It was to be run by HMRC, and it was to be run like pay-as-you-earn income tax, on the basis where you kind of pay an amount on account, and then it's all worked out at the end of the year how much you should have paid, or how much, in this case, you should have got, and then an adjustment is made. And I think at that point there was a huge underestimate, despite some warnings that had come from Australia, where they'd had a similar system, that basing what you were paying people in 1 year on what they'd earned the year and a half before might well turn out to be wrong. And indeed it did. And millions of people ended up being overpaid, and the system came back and tried to claim money back from them. The whole system became very unpopular. Now, you can see the government's current universal credit reforms as in many ways a reaction trying to solve that problem, that they will get it right first time, because everybody's employers' computers will now, at the end of the month, be sending up to HMRC, because of tax data, what everybody's earned on their payroll this month. And then that will be married up in the DWP computer. And then on the first of the month, whichever it is, exactly the right amount of money will be paid out as universal credit. That's designed to cope with, rapidly, to adjust for people's fluctuating lives. So that's a huge move forward, this real-time information system. But there are some other sides of it that make one worry about how this is going to work when it's dealing with less complicated cases than the 18,000, actually it's a few more now, the 25,000 people who are currently on universal credit, who are all, generally speaking, simple cases. When it's up and running and coping with 7.7 million people, there will be 1.6 million changes in circumstance every month for the system to cope with. Now, actually, banks, building societies, all sorts of people cope with lots of change, but I think it's quite brave to think of a system that will cope with that. But there are other sides of this that, you know, we've had. It's obviously daft at the moment that we have one system for how we treat people when they're in work, if you're doing the right number of hours, and that's quite light touch, and you're not hounded as to whether you're doing enough. We have another system for people who are out of work, who are under a lot of pressure, subject to sanctioning and all sorts of things. Yeah. Universal credit does away with that. But the cost of that is that what happens about the somebody person who says, I'm going to do 8 hours a week? Yeah. They're going to have a system of policing the people who are doing 8 hours a week in a zero-hours contract world, where you may not know which hour you're going to be working to turn up at an interview next week. Yeah. And where now your employer may realise, in the same way we've always been worried about in-work benefits, meaning that employers can cut wages, actually employers may increasingly turn around and say, hold on, why should I take the risk of the demand for my shop or whatever it is going up and down during the week when Universal Credit will take all the risk? Why shouldn't I put all my staff on a 0 hours contract with the state taking the downside risk? So those fluctuations, I think, cause huge problems for almost any system.
Yeah, indeed. I'm going to open it out now. I mean, there's a recurring theme here, you know, a complex set of challenges, complex solutions, interfacing with complex lives, with this sort of need to police people as well that's politically driven. And this is what's creating the challenges, the overarching challenge, I think. I'm going to go for this gentleman here first.
Thanks. I wonder if either of the speakers would extrapolate on their graphs about old age, about how the state, if their predictions come true, will manage people presumably living into longer lifetimes with comorbidities and long-term conditions. How would that be paid for if not through private insurance?
Okay, thank you.
Hi, I work for a campaigning charity for the homeless. I'm interested in how the bedroom tax narrative is different to the other benefit cuts, and how, despite attempts by some of the tabloids to rubbish the food bank work that's been done, that's not happened. I'm just interested in why the narrative around those two is different in the public mind.
Great, thank you.
I work with the Citizens Advice Bureau, and while I agree with virtually everything you're both saying, it also strikes me that you're preaching to the converted, and I haven't got a clue what you think you're going to be able to achieve with these books, good as they are.
Well, let's keep some optimistic frame of mind. But Tom, bedroom tax, old age, and we're back to the convincing question again.
Yeah, no, and it's the most, you're right to press it because it's the most important question. Look, good politicians know that the way you talk about things matters a lot. And that is a lesson with a lot of implications for this area. In America, the great case study of this is so-called, I think, estate duty originally that became the death tax. Death's a bad thing. We feel sorry for people who have to go through death. So we don't think you should be taxing them when they're dying. And therefore, like, even though only 1% of people or whatever it was in America were paying death tax, this became a moral cause and people rallied to it. Now, partly because he was embarrassed about what he was doing, I think, or not confident in making the case for it, Gordon Brown didn't want to talk about benefits. He wanted to talk about tax credits. He wanted to pretend this was a negative income tax. And basically, the rationale of what he was doing was giving people money by reason of them being poor, rather than by something else. Poor as defined by, you know, a decile chart or a kind of equivalized income or something that's quite alien to the way that people talk about things and alien to the identities that people have. We know from surveys of, whether people think they're rich or poor, that they get it wildly wrong. And most people, whether they're really quite rich or really quite poor, think they're in the middle. And so when you talk about giving people money because they're poor, that doesn't go down well. And I think that does get you into thinking that you need to set the discussion on a different basis, whether it be the kind of more universal rights-based approach you're talking about or the more social insurance type approach John's talking about. Those two examples there, food banks and bedroom taxes, are both very interesting on that. People are not interested and never were really interested in lifting children out of poverty. 1.6 million people taken above the 60% of equivalized income line or whatever it is that the Treasury defined. When people talk about poverty, who aren't policy wonks, they talk about not having a warm winter coat or holes in your shoes or whatever, or about too many people having to share a bedroom because that's something concrete. And so or people going hungry. So these discussions about bedrooms and about people going hungry strike an altogether different note and get through in a way that no statistics ever will. And of course, with bedroom tax, it's been very important to brand it as a tax rather than removal of the subsidy. And the government's spin there hasn't worked at all.
Great. Thank you, Tom. So, John, I mean, this point about old age, I mean, is this one part of the system that obviously has political support, that it's kind of resolved, that we can relax about, or are there still exceedingly big challenges?
I think there are huge challenges. I think we're kidding ourselves if we think we can manage the effects of the fertility decline that happened in the 1960s after the baby boomers without it costing all of us more money. And the fairest way of collecting that money being through the tax system. If we sometimes think of the baby boomers, some of whom are in the audience, as being the problem. In fact, the baby boomers have been the solution. A big generation has been available to pay tax for a smaller, older generation. That's now changing. That's unwinding over the next 20 years. And that means that unless we're prepared to make the whole system, healthcare, social care, pensions, meaner in relation to what we've been used to in relation to our incomes, we're going to have to pay more for it. Now, obviously, private insurance is a potential solution. We have to remember, though, if people are paying for private insurance, they're going to be less willing to pay for other taxes. And if we're thinking of private insurance for things like long-term care in the future, there are some really, really big insurance market problems there. You're thinking of the time when you've got the money in your working life, coping with a completely uncertain cost and need and technology in 30 or 40 years' time that you've got to put money aside for. You've got to cope with a system, if it's voluntary, of who's going to buy that. Are the people who are going to buy it the ones who know they're a bad risk, not the people who are a good risk? I did some work on that kind of insurance a few years ago, and I looked at one of the policies that was available at the time, and for some reason I started leafing through it from the back. And it had this wonderful list of, you know, I can't remember all the conditions, but it was a fantastic comprehensive list. And it got to Alzheimer's. And, well, I went started whatever begins with Z, and I got to Alzheimer's. And I thought, wow. And then I saw that this section was headed exclusions. And it's incredibly hard to buy a policy 20 years ahead and get right, you know, the value for money of all of that. So I think that's a problem. Let me go, but both on the bedroom tax and the Scotland debate. Yeah, very briefly. But I think one of the hopeful things in the political debate recently was what I saw of vox pops in the run-up to the Scottish referendum. There may have been people here who were there, where a lot of people were voicing their anger about the perceived injustice of things that had happened through welfare reform of one kind or another. And often it was the bedroom tax that was mentioned, despite the fact that actually you don't pay the bedroom tax in Scotland because the Scottish government offsets it for you. But it was seen as a symbol of unfairness, and I think given that it only affects people who have 3%, that's 3% of the nation's spare bedrooms are the people affected by the bedroom tax, and there's nowhere for a lot of people to move in a lot of places. You can see why it is. Are we wasting our breath? Well, I published this book and had a bit of a launch, and there was a bit of media coverage of it. And then on the Monday morning, I had a telephone call from a television company. Now, one of the things I talked about were things like Benefit Street, and I'd had the misfortune to be part of a programme called Nick and Margaret, We Pay All Your Benefits, at one point. Yeah, so they're terribly nice people, but the programme seemed to be rather different from what I talked to them about. And I thought, right, here is a television company who've listened to what I've said, and they're going to put a different side of it, how it really is. And she talked for a while, and I said, oh, yeah, OK, that's very interesting. And then she said, and we're going to call this programme Born, Married and Died on Benefit. And I thought, OK, I have entirely wasted my breath. So please just give these books to people on Christmas. Tell them to look at the link. Tell them to look at some of the blogs that are around on this. I don't know how you get the word around, but people who are working in CABs, who have experience of what's going on the ground, talk to people about how it is, because you are fighting against quite a big amount of misinformation that's coming from a different direction.
Great. It was great to hear someone defend the baby boomers. They get such a hard time. So anyway, well, let's take a very quick fire round of three again.
Yeah, it's more of a point, really. I think perhaps what it also is that there's been a narrowing of the political discourse around who's actually talking about issues. More public school people within the political system, trade unions aren't really involved in the same way that they were, the advice sector, legal aid cuts, and perhaps it's something about the fact the complicated lives that people lead, that we're only seeing in narrower and narrower complications about people that we can relate to. And I think there's a particular issue there. I mean, we had Cathy Come Home, and that hit people. Yeah.
So these voices are not in the political debate, yeah, they're ultimately, not. because they're concentrating on getting and holding down.
The housing campaigns in London, you know, it was, you know, whatever you think of them, it was the kind of Russell Brand stuff and all that kind of stuff. It's good. Kind of, where's the kind of mainstream political discourse? Are we a metropolitan class? That kind of debate.
Thank you.
Thank you. In Canada, our right-wing government has taken away health care for refugees unless they have a communicable disease. So I'm wondering, what is this, this picking on the poor and the helpless, the most desperate members of our society? Is it class warfare? Is it smart economics? And don't they expect any kind of pushback? I mean, they just keep pushing and pushing.
Thank you.
There's been a bit of bad press about the captains of industry and the top bankers, but far, I think it's not in proportion to the amount that they do not contribute properly to welfare. And most poor people, as you say, they seem to be fighting amongst themselves rather than the, I think the attack should be against the captains of industry who are not investing. They're taking huge, huge salaries, etc., etc.
No, I think we've got the point. Yeah. Thank you very much. So, John, very briefly in a minute, what is it? What is this politics? What's it about?
I think the point about who... I'm an example. I'm an LSE professor. If you look at my income across the year and you draw a graph of it, it does that. Maybe there's a little... enough of you buy the book, there'll be a little. And I think that's true of civil servants as well. And I think the way we talk about it is divorced because it's not because people in the middle don't know about what's happening to their children, but because I think some people at the top are isolated from this and are thinking about a world which doesn't reflect the people who come into the CABs. So I'd agree with that completely.
Thank you. Tom, this lack... we're focusing now on the wealthy and tax avoidance, so on and so forth. Why aren't people connecting the dots, I guess, is the question.
Well, it's a very good question about what voices are heard in my own modest way, and I'm aware it's a restricted audience. You know, I've tried to bring in... We've got 25 or 30 families interviewed in the book so we can hear what they're saying directly. It's harder for people than it has been in the past for them to organise and speak collectively. I was learning yesterday about this thing called Amazon Mechanical Turk, where people are able to do online work as freelance contractors and get paid, you know, often £1 or £1.50 an hour for the privilege of doing so. But because they're contractors and they never meet the other contractors, it's very hard for them to stand up. It is difficult in this very fractured, electronically organised world for people to find their voices collectively. So you've got to get the politics right. And, of course, we've all got to try and get the politics right this side of a general election. I'd just leave the points I've made already, really, but with 3 points about what I think we can do to get the politics in better shape. First of all, get the language right. Don't talk about relative poverty rates or statistics. Talk about bedroom taxes and food banks. Secondly, make that crucial link back from the workless poor to the working poor, both in terms of first, the benefits and the housing benefit that goes to people who need help to pay their rent now, but also what you're left with if the safety net's pulled away, which is people scrambling around with each other in horrible competition for jobs that invites a race to the bottom. I think that's a message that people will understand. And finally, think about there's going to be a disgruntlement. People are going to be fed up because they've had years and years where living standards have been tending to get worse rather than better, as we're used to. And so there is going to be anger, and think about where usefully you can channel that.
Great, thank you. Now, both of these remarkable books are available for purchase. I'd encourage you to buy both, if you can possibly afford it. I'm not going to have any favouritism here. I'm sure John and Tom may be willing to sign a copy for you, or both your copies, as the case may be. Thank you very much to all of you for coming along. Thank you very much to John Hills and Tom Clark for a superb discussion, and hopefully the first of many. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.